You're listening to the FQXI podcast. I'm Zia Morali. An extra special thank you to you for coming to QSpace and visiting the Foundational Questions Institute website to listen to this extended version of the countdown. In this bonus extra, FQXI quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire and I chat about some of the physics advances that just missed out on being named as one of FQXI's top five stories of 2024. All the teams mentioned in this edition are eligible for one free FQXI t-shirt each. So if you hear your work called out, please do reach out and claim it by emailing us at podcast@fqxi.org. And other listeners are also welcome to email us too. Shall we begin with this year's runners-up?
Yeah, let's start with the first one, which is just kind of a fun story. So most of us know what, well, maybe know what antimatter is. It's regular matter, but that has all of its internal constants flipped. So like electric charge, and there are some other little funky things that are characteristics that get flipped if they become antimatter. So an electron has an antimatter counterpart called a positron, which is exactly like an electron, except it has a positive charge. The funny thing about antimatter is that a positron and an electron that bump into each other annihilate. They just vanish into energy. They just boom, kaboom, there's energy. There's nothing left. So transporting antimatter around is difficult. But at CERN, a bunch of scientists transported a truck full of antimatter. And when I say a truck full, it was 70 protons.
A teeny-weeny truck that went on a little road trip.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure. It wasn't a teeny-weeny truck. It was, even though it was only 70 protons, it was actually a rather large machine.
This was the base step experiment at CERN that took a cloud of 70 protons on a trip of 4 kilometers around the lab site. As announced in October, in a special trap that could potentially stop antimatter annihilating with surrounding matter. The researchers already have a version of the trap in the lab, in which antimatter is suspended in an electromagnetic field to keep it from touching the surrounding matter. Now they have shrunk this trap down to a portable version that is 1.9 meters long so that it can sit on a not teeny-weeny truck, but quite a big truck that can protect it from bumps and shakes as it travels around. We'll link to a story about this with images on qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts.
If you go to one of the links, you can see a picture of this particle trap being lifted up by a crane before being loaded on a truck. And then to think that that giant thing, which looks like it's about the size of maybe 6 human adults, only has 70 protons in it. You may be like, well, wait a minute, they were using protons in this. Why weren't they using antiprotons, which is really the antimatter? The answer is that this was a proof of concept, which is why it's not in the top five.
One of the links that I looked at was from The Guardian, which described antimatter as matter's evil twin, which I quite liked. They went for the angle that this could be the most dangerous delivery truck in the world ever.
Yes.
And I think a few places did mention that this had been part of the plot of the film Angels and Demons, maybe, that there was antimatter traveling around. Is this dangerous, Ian?
No.
Could it go wrong?
No.
You shut that down quite quickly. It was getting quite exciting, but no.
Yeah, no. We should not be concerned about this because there's not a lot of antimatter out there. There's not enough of it to actually cause something to vanish and go kabloom.
So like, even if it leaked out of the trap, it wouldn't be like, oh no, the scientist's hand has disappeared or something. No.
Not enough. Even if they were to do 1 million, you might lose a molecule or something in your hand, but...
Why do we want to be shipping antimatter around? What's the point of that? Why can't they just keep it at CERN and do experiments there?
Well, so that's an interesting thing. There's not a lot of antimatter around. If you want to do experiments with antimatter, it's hard to find it out there. I mean, CERN can produce it, and there are places that can produce it, but, you know, maybe some university somewhere wants to do some research with it, but they don't have the ability to produce large quantities of it on their own. Well, eventually, maybe you'll be able to call up CERN and say, hey, ship me 100 antiprotons. You know, they'll ship them on a truck and send them your way.
Do you remember when there was all that fuss about the fact that they were going to create black holes at the LHC?
Yes. I remember back in the 90s at one point, the people were concerned that Brookhaven National Lab over here in on Long Island in the U.S. was going to create black holes in the laboratory. I can't even remember what they were doing, but people were freaking out and thinking, oh my God, Long Island's going to turn into a black hole. And then there were jokes about Long Island being a black hole already. But for listeners who are from Long Island, my wife is a native of Long Island, so I have permission to make fun of Long Island.
Right then, enough of Matter's evil twin. Let's move on to our next runner-up.
So this one is another particle physics thing. There is a long-standing problem regarding the magnetic moment of muons.
Remind us what a muon is.
They're kind of like a sibling of the electron. They're like a heavy electron. Most often they're produced by cosmic rays in the atmosphere. If you ever take a photograph with your digital camera or your phone and you've completely blocked the lens so that it's just a black photograph, and if you zoom in and you see any non-black dots, if there are a cluster of them together, that's a muon, most likely. If it's a single black dot, that means you have a bad pixel. But if it's multiple black dots, it's likely a muon. You tend to get more on airplanes, which is kind of fun. But anyway, the muon has a thing called a magnetic moment. There's a magnetic field, essentially, that we refer to it as a magnetic moment. It behaves a little bit like a little bar magnet. And the attempts to measure the magnetic moment of the muon, though, have led to an anomaly. There's a slight but noticeable departure from what theory says it should be.
This is the muon G-2 experiment, which began at Brookhaven and then moved to Fermilab. G here refers to the magnetic moment of the muon. The plan was that Fermilab, which is still working on its final results, would make even more precise measurements. So far, the experimental results just seem to make the discrepancy with the theoretical prediction for the muon's magnetic moment even stronger. The current deviation is just over 4 sigma, or standard deviations, where the gold standard for claiming a particle physics discovery, so saying that you really are seeing a true effect, is 5 sigma. If it keeps getting stronger, it leaves us with the possibility, intriguingly, that the standard model of particle physics being used to predict the value is wrong, opening up room for perhaps the existence of new particles or forces. Or is there a third option? A bit of a compromise.
Now, the new results are, it's a theoretical calculation. It's a runner-up because it hasn't been fully accepted yet by the community. But the new calculation says that, no, there is not a problem with this deviation. It's a flaw in the technique that's used by the majority of people working in the theoretical community. So basically, it says that the way we've been calculating it in the standard model up until now is flawed.
What's new about this calculation then?
They used new techniques in quantum chromodynamics, which is the field theory that essentially underlies the strong nuclear interaction, a thing called lattice QCD, to supposedly say that there really isn't a problem. Maybe we should just briefly explain a little bit about this. So G is supposed to be 2. But G is not exactly equal to 2. G equaling 2 is predicted by basic quantum mechanics, so old school kind of stuff. The fact that it's not exactly 2 is generally explained by quantum field theory.
I wanted to ask you about this, actually, Ian, mm-hmm. because, you know, sometimes, and I'm guilty of this as well when I'm writing articles, sometimes I'll just happily write, you know, quantum mechanics predicts that.
Yeah.
And then other times I'll happily write, quantum field theory happily predicts that. What's the difference if you're not a physicist? What's the difference between, you know, we say quantum physics and sometimes we mean quantum mechanics and sometimes we mean quantum field theory? How are these two things different?
That is a big question, but yeah, let me see if I can explain it quickly. So quantum mechanics is a set of mathematical principles that match experiment. It applies to basic particles. The problem is that you get kind of funky when you get into trying to explain things like the strong and weak nuclear interactions, or if you have a lot of matter in one place and maybe it's highly condensed or something like that. It also doesn't do very well explaining light, so which is kind of funny. And so some of these early puzzles led to the creation of quantum field theory very early. Like as quantum mechanics developed in the 20s, quantum field theory was really started to get developed almost at the same time. And the difference is in quantum field theory is that typically what you do is you start with a field, like an electromagnetic field, and then you quantize it. And the particles are like, you think of a bed sheet that's really tight, and that's the field. Then you walk up and you take a little piece of it and you just twist it between your fingers, and that's the particle in the field. So that's the quantized field. And the equations are completely different. That's basically the big difference, is that quantum field theory applies to these things that have spatial extension, whereas quantum mechanics deals with localized particles.
So we were in a state of thinking, well, there could be something wrong with the experiment here, but better experiments were sort of reinforcing the same anomaly. Or it could be that the standard model was completely wrong and we might need some new physics to explain it. We might need new particles, new forces, some other kind of exotic, weird new thing happening. But in this case, people have gone, well, the standard model isn't actually wrong. It's just some of the nuances of how you have to calculate these very precise numbers. You have to use a slightly different technique or a different way of kind of approaching this problem. And when you do that calculation using lattice QCD, there's no anomaly.
That is correct. So we frequently in physics like to idealize things. If I drop a baseball out my window, I don't really care what's going on in Tokyo at the moment, right? It's not going to affect my baseball.
Just to be clear, you don't live in Tokyo. You're not dropping the baseball on somebody's head and you just don't care about them at all.
I do not live in Tokyo. No, no, no. And I love Tokyo, but I don't care about them if I'm dropping out baseball out my window on the east coast of the United States. So you don't care about the environment in many cases, and we idealize that. But in the case of a muon, the strong nuclear interaction apparently attributes to the muon's G value. What they did with lattice QCD is they were trying to calculate directly the contribution of the particles in the fields from the strong interaction to the muon's magnetic moment. And what they did was they basically used a diagram. It's like a two-dimensional, I mean, I guess it's really supposed to be three-dimensional grid, a lattice, hence the term lattice. And they calculate them to higher degrees of accuracy. And space and time get discretized into a set of grid-like points, which is why you have this lattice. And then what they do is they decrease the spacing between the points, and the overall size of the lattice then tends towards infinity. And on each of the points in this lattice, you have quarks and gluons, and they're contributing to the G value of the muon. But it didn't make my list until it becomes, you know, kind of textbook lattice QCD.
I should work out who's done this so that we know who is eligible to claim their t-shirts. Oh, there are a lot of authors on this.
Yes, it's CERN, so.
So the authors of the paper, High Precision Calculation of the Hadronic Vacuum Polarization Contribution. See, Carl has got into my head now, and I don't know how to pronounce any words beginning with C-O-N-T. Basically, I think the moral of this story is that anyone can contact us and claim
pretty much
a free t-shirt, and we won't know.
Yeah, we won't know. We will have no idea.
We'll just be like, sure, we believe you.
Absolutely.
You're probably one of the 20,000 people on one of these papers.
Yeah.
Have a free t-shirt. We check these things very thoroughly. Honestly, we verify things. We definitely know what we're talking about here.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, we shall move on quickly to the next runner-up.
All right, so the next runner-up is another new mathematical discovery that promises to unlock some of the keys to emergence. Emergence is a really intriguing problem. We could have an entire podcast on emergence. I've been long interested in emergence and complexity.
If you go to the FQXI website fqxi.org and go to our reports and publications page, you will see that the brilliant George Musser wrote a 60-page review of Emergence for us a couple of years ago, which covered everything from condensed matter physics to the emergence of space and time.
Yes, George is a great writer.
I'll put a link on the podcast page, qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts.
So this new way of looking at emergence involves some big names in the field. The paper was led by a guy named Fernando Rosas. He's a complex systems scientist at the University of Sussex. And one of his co-authors was Anil Seth, and I'm sure many listeners probably know who Anil Seth is. Anil Seth is very well known in emergence and complexity circles and also in consciousness circles. And there were also five additional co-authors, and they have a new framework for understanding how emergence arises. And so let me just briefly say, I won't do the 60 pages of George, but I'll say a little bit about emergence, right? So consciousness, I think, is one of the examples. Is consciousness an emergent property? If you put enough molecules together and you eventually get something, well, you get consciousness. If it's, I don't know, it's put together in a certain way. That is sort of the essence of emergence. How certain properties only exist at certain levels. I mean, another really silly example is just a car. You know, you have a wheel and you have an axle and you have a door and you have an engine. And all of those things are separate, and it only becomes a car when you put enough of them together. So a car is kind of emergent.
So what is this new work?
These guys have a new way of looking at it using something called computational mechanics. They're looking for a particular hierarchical structure. Usually, what we think of when we think of emergence, we think of it in terms of hierarchies. Certain things exist at certain hierarchical levels. A car exists at a different hierarchical level than a car's engine. You know, you exist at a different hierarchical level than your organs, for example, or something like that. I'm going to put in a plug for another book. There's an interesting book written by FQXI member George Ellis.
I knew that one was coming. Yeah, definitely.
Can physics underlie the brain or something like that?
Can physics underlie the mind? I'll put a link on the podcast page, qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts.
And he talks about hierarchical levels in that. So they used computational mechanics, and they basically identified criteria for which systems have a certain hierarchical structure. And they basically then tested the criteria on a bunch of different model systems that are known to display emergent type phenomena. One of the perfect examples is Conway's Game of Life. And all of these things have very precise relationships. And this new model does a good job of predicting them for some of these systems.
What does this help us to understand now that we perhaps couldn't understand before?
The idea of studying emergence is to understand why and how they emerge from the smaller things. One of the important things about emergence is, and I literally spent my entire November in Wisconsin with fellow FQXI members, Kelvin McQueen and Larissa Albantakis, working on issues related to this, but there's this notion of causality. Could causality be emergent? And the work by Rosas and Seth et al., their definition is when a macro system can predict what it will do itself as much as it can be predicted from the micro level. I mean, the greatest problem of emergence is to really figure out how the heck you can get from quantum mechanics to cars and trucks, because we still don't know that. There are some things that happen at the emergent level that we don't fully understand yet. So,
okay, Ian, let me ask you now about what I know is a favorite topic of yours, free will.
Okay.
If you visit QSpace or our YouTube channel, you will see Ian giving a talk about his own research on free will. And I will, of course, put a link to that on the podcast page. I was amused because the article that you sent me about this just has this sort of throwaway paragraph at the end saying that the new work touches on free will. But then the article just sort of ended on this very intriguing, tantalizing note. I know you're an expert on the topic, so can you tell us how this new work plays into the debate about the emergence of free will, if indeed it does?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the million-dollar question. I've done a couple of things on free will. I'm doing another one now. I mean, I think it's a very interesting result that could help us address that issue.
But I guess, you know, what I guess this comes to just a question of what emergence really means, maybe, in the sense that you gave the example of a car, that this is on a different hierarchical level from, you know, its parts. But, you know, it's still a mechanical, physical thing, and the way it behaves is still going to be related to those parts, even if it's somehow more than the sum of its parts. It can still be explained by its parts. Yeah. But if we're talking about free will emerging, and we're trying to get around the problem where people say, oh, you know, you're just made up of your molecules and whatever, and they all, you know, fire deterministically the neurons in your brain or whatever, and so there's no kind of freedom or will in your free will. And then you get to sort of the quantum part and you say, well, there could be freedom because, as you say, everything could be random. You still haven't got the will part of your free will. And I'm not sure how saying, well, it just emerges gets around the problem of, okay, but how does the will part emerge?
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't really. Right. There was a philosopher, I think it was Timothy O'Connor or Robert Nozick, I can't remember which one it was, said something about, there are really two questions. There's the questions of whether you fundamentally have free will, and that's separate from, you know, if you have free will, do you have free will at a given instant from the choice that you make? So, for instance, arguably, assuming we do actually have free will, arguably, we're less free if we're in prison than we are not in prison, or like our choices are limited when we're on an airplane. And there's a certain sense in which the underlying argument about free will, does free will even exist? Personally, I almost think that's unanswerable by science, which is funny because I work on it and I've written papers on it. So I think in that regard, yeah, we will never answer the deep, deep question about free will. But as I have made clear, is that we behave as if we have free will. And that behavior in and of itself warrants explanation. Why and how do we exert our free will?
Well, as your friend, Ian, and given that we're working on this podcast for the Foundational Questions Institute, which funds science, I feel like even though I'm not really involved in the actual funding decisions, I should say to you, if you are applying for a grant to study free will, don't start your application with this question is fundamentally unanswerable by science. That's not going to help you there. Yeah. Be more ambitious. Say, you know, I give me 3 years, I'll have the answer for you. Now let's emerge from that discussion.
All right.
And turn to the next runner or runners up.
Runners up. There are some advances this year in quantum computing with different machines. So one of the major, major problems with quantum computing is error correction. So all computers have error correction fundamentally built in. You have to do error correction. Every so often a bit flips. You have to correct for that. It's currently showing up in the fact that your picture is kind of freezing on me every so often. In a quantum computer, it's really problematic because, you know, in a classical computer, you might encode something, you know, like the letter A might be encoded with, I don't know, 10 bits or something like that. I mean, fundamental bits. A fundamental bit is literally a switch inside of a microchip. It's usually it's 5 volts. If it's above 5 volts, it's on. If it's below 5 volts, it's off. So it's either a 1 or a 0. At the classical level, if you encode the letter A a certain way with a certain number of physical bits, one might not be right. One might flip. But it's okay because you don't have to be that precise. There's error correction built in to the system so that, oh, yep, okay, it knows it's an A. Even though one of the bits may be corrupt, it knows it's an A. The quantum case is a little trickier. Getting quantum qubits, which are the quantum bits, qubits decay it's very hard to keep them coherent, meaning keep them in the state you want them in for long periods of time because they interact with their environment so strongly. This is a major problem with quantum computers, and it's a problem for scaling up. This is why quantum computers still have only done some relatively simple calculations that you could do classically fairly easily. But the guys at Google have exceeded a threshold with some of the work that they're doing with their qubit design.
So that's Google Quantum AI, who posted a paper in August, which has now been published in Nature in December. They've shown for the first time that they can make a quantum computer significantly more resilient by adding more qubits. They used their new quantum chip Willow, which has 105 physical qubits. A link to their paper is on the podcast page, qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts, along with links to another advance in quantum computing, because we have a joint runner-up here with a team from Quantinuum that crossed another important performance threshold. Ian.
Google in 2019 had set a benchmark for quantum advantage, or quantum primacy, as if you go back and listen to one of our previous podcasts, I called it quantum primacy, which is how much better a quantum system does over or classical system. And the folks at Quantinuum, which chief science officer is FQXI member Bob Kuka,
who probably doesn't want one of our t-shirts, to be fair, because he has his own style, and I don't know if how.
Well, I mean, if we made it like, you know, black metal kind of thing, he might like it. But anyway, Bob's company Quantinuum has beaten Google's Sycamore machine by 100 times using their new 56-qubit H21 computer. The cool thing is that it consumes 30,000 times less power, which is great because at the moment, quantum computers are pretty energy intensive, and we'd like to get that down. Just a little side note here. One of the problems that the world is facing in the future, I mean, one of the many problems, is that I believe I read somewhere that AI currently actually uses more energy than Bitcoin mining, which already uses an insane amount of the world's energy.
Yeah, we keep hearing crazy, stupid numbers. I am pulling this from an article in Nature, which says here that according to the International Energy Agency, in 2022, data centers consumed 1.65 billion gigajoules of electricity, about 2% of global demand. Widespread deployment of AI will only increase electricity usage, and by 2026, the agency projects that data centers' energy consumption will have increased by between 35% and 128%. These amounts, they say, are equivalent to adding the annual energy consumption of Sweden at the lower end or Germany at the high end. The BBC also reported that generative AI uses 33 times more electricity than task-specific software because it's having to create basically everything from scratch.
That's going to be a real problem. If quantum computers can do some of this more efficiently, it might be helpful in that regard.
I have a question about quantum computers.
All right.
I don't know that I personally have this question, but I keep seeing this on social media about these stories and other stories. It's something that used to be said a while back, and then it kind of fell out of fashion, and it seems to have come back. And I have my own feelings about this, but I'd like to know what you do. And it is that every time there is this sort of quantum computing success in recent months, a lot of people say, well, this proves David Deutsch right, that parallel universes exist because quantum computers are computing in parallel universes. And I thought that was something that people had forgotten about, but it's come back. And I want a word from you, Ian. Does this prove that parallel universes exist?
No.
Thank you.
No.
That's the end of that.
No. Beck, with all due respect to David Deutsch, no. You don't need many worlds interpretation. I'm probably not the best person to ask about this only because I don't have a pet interpretation of quantum mechanics, but I will say I'm not a fan of many worlds. I would say ask Tim Maudlin about this.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, Tim Maudlin will most certainly say no, you know, or ask any Bohmian. Many worlds is just a way to explain the correlations that happen in quantum mechanics. Many worlds is one way.
Thank you, Ian. I don't have any particular feelings one way or the other about the many worlds interpretation. I think it's as good as any other. I guess I just wanted to put it out there that whenever you see somebody saying that these quantum computing successes prove finally that parallel worlds exist, that you should know that there are other interpretations available.
There are, yes.
So,
and I'm going to just put out a shout out to your book.
Oh, thank you for mentioning my book,
which talks about the fact that there are actually two different many worlds concepts out there. There's the quantum mechanics many worlds, which comes out of Hugh Everett's stuff, but then there's the other many worlds, which is the fact that there could be an infinite number of worlds that come out of the fact that in the early starting of the universe, there were parts of the universe that got isolated from one another, and they sort of basically are their own universe. You have a whole book about that, which I think people should go and read.
Yeah, go buy the book, A Big Bang in a Little Room.
Yes.
I forgot the name of it there. It's been such a long time since.
So did I.
but you've got an excuse to forget it. I wrote it, so I should remember it. Different types of parallel universes, none of which have been proven to exist by the existence of quantum computers. So I guess that's the take home of this particular section. So there you have all of our runners up. Thank you for joining us on QSpace to listen to this bonus material discussing achievements, all honourable, I note, no dishonourable, that almost but didn't quite make our top five. Congratulations to the Base Step experiment at CERN for their antimatter truck, to A. Boccoletti and colleagues for potentially sidestepping the muon magnetic moment anomaly, to Fernando Rosas and colleagues for their computational approach to hierarchical emergence, and to Google Quantum AI and to Quantinuum for significant leaps in quantum computing. Links to all the items that we discussed are on the podcast page, which is where you are at the moment, on the right, and you'll also see links to George Musser's Emergence Review and an accompanying book that span out of it, George Ellis's book on whether physics can underlie the mind, and my own book, which Ian very kindly plugged, and I promise I didn't prompt him to do that, A Big Bang in a Little Room, in which I interview a range of cosmologists, quantum physicists, and particle physicists about the possibility of building a universe in the laboratory. I talk a lot about parallel worlds and a bit about free will in the book. If you purchase these or any other books through FQXI's bookshop, you'll also donate a small amount to FQXI, so thank you in advance for that. Now you can stay on FQXI's podcast page, or return to your favourite podcatcher, or to YouTube, to listen to what has made it onto our top five in the main podcast. While you're at it, follow us on pretty much any of the socials as FQXI or at FQXI Physics. And if you're feeling generous, please consider dropping a donation to FQXI through our site. The link is in the show notes. Your help supports not just this podcast and the conferences and the talks, where you can hear Ian's thoughts on free will, but also the mini documentaries you can find on our YouTube channel, and most importantly, a lot of groundbreaking research into foundational science made by our members that is not funded by conventional government grants. Thank you once again for joining Ian and myself. I've been Zia Morali.